This is our 110th lecture on the apocalypse. I've entitled it, Death Takes a Vacation. It is the seventh seal, the fifth blast of the shofar, and the first woe. I want you to turn to Revelation chapter 9, beginning in verse 1. And the fifth angel sounded his shofar, and I saw a meteor out of the heaven that had descended into the earth. And there was given to him the key of the shaft that descends to the abyss. And he opened the shaft to the abyss. And there went up smoke out of the shaft as the smoke of a great furnace. And the sun and the atmosphere were darkened with the smoke of the shaft. And out of the smoke came forth locusts onto the earth. And power was given to them as the scorpions of the earth have power. And it was said to them that they should not injure the grass of the earth, nor any green thing, nor any tree, only the men who have not the seal of God on their foreheads. And a command was given to them that they should not kill them, but that they should be tormented 5 months. And their torturous agony was as the torment of a scorpion when it strikes a man. And in those days shall men seek death, and shall in no way find it. They shall long to die, and death flees from them. And the resemblance of the locusts were very much like horses prepared for war. And upon their heads were, as it were, victor's crowns, resembling the colour of gold, and their faces as faces like men. And they possessed hair like women's hair, and their teeth were like those of lions. And they had a breastplate like a breastplate of iron. And the sound of their wings was like the sound of moving chariots of many horses running to battle. And they have tails like scorpions and stings, and their power was in their tails to injure men 5 months. They have a king over them. That is the angel of the abyss. His name in Hebrew, Abaddon, and in Greek he has the name Apollyon. Woe one has passed. There come now two woes after these things. Okay. Explain that one. John, first of all, does not say that he sees the meteor fall. Oh, no. No, he doesn't. He simply states it was fallen. Now, that's past tense. So that may have been millennia ago, for all we know. We have no way of knowing. That's a point I want to make out. But we do know this. There is an abyss. You know, we live in a very strange, enchanted world. When we wake up in the morning, we do our normal activities around the house, go to work, whatever it is. On the weekend, we have our schedules of what we want. We have our TV shows that are our favourite shows. We live in a very,
privileged.
Well, I wasn't going to say... Well, yes, privileged. Yes, privileged kind of lifestyle. But we're certainly everything's the dotting of the I and the crossing of the T, and it's normal.
Routine.
Normalcy. Routine. And yet our planet is filled with wonder. It teems with mysteries. And it's a world in which nothing is as it is perceived to be. Imagine getting up one morning and going out the front yard to be greeted by a shower of frogs on your front lawn from an otherwise cloudless sky. It's happened. Or being swamped with millions of acorns out of a cloud miles up in the air. Or it's raining cats. Or it's raining dogs. Or it's raining stinking, foul, decaying flesh. All of these things are on record as occurring. And the acorns, cats, and the dogs happen over and over again. We might think we have most species of the earth catalogued. And then one day, out of a jungle clearing in Asia, comes a mastodon, replete with tusks and long hair. Out of another location, jungle location in Nepal, comes a beautiful deer that comes out of the jungle into an area where people normally have their picnics. Westerners have their picnics. And the difference between this deer and other deers is that it's got gills. There have even been reports from the deep Congo, insistent reports and persistent reports, of a water creature uncannily representative of the extinct Pliosaurus, or Plesiosaurus. And it eats anyone who gets too close to the swamp's edge. Sometimes, depending where we live, we earthlings have experienced huge blocks of ice falling out of the sky and going right through the bonnet of the car. Now, it's never happened to me, but it's been recorded and photographed as happening. And in England a few years ago, a 40-foot block of ice, 40-foot square, fell out of the sky and went right through the house. The husband was at work. The lady was putting her washing on the line to see her house demolished by a 40-foot block of ice. Imagine how big that ice was to have to come through the Van Allen belt and still be 40 foot long when it lands on her house. In Australia, we find Min Min lights. Min Min lights. You can fire your gun at them and they disappear, only to prop up somewhere else and dance around as if, try me over here. Over here. Right? They play with us. They're intelligent, whatever these little lights are. And of course, in the rest of the world, they call them jack-o'-lanterns or will-o'-the-wisp. These things happen. But in Australia, they're not relegated to swamp areas. So it's not swamp gas. Not in this country. Some of these actually chase cars across a nullarbor. On YouTube, you can actually see and watch the experience of this family who are travelling across South Australia on the Nullarbor Plains, and they're frantic because they're actually filming with their mobile these lights coming at them, and they're zooming at them and racing off and coming back at them again, and the car's going all over the place. And the woman's screaming, and the kids are crying, and suddenly it stops.
Can I mention one of the students in one of my subjects at uni?
Yeah.
We had to write poetry, and hers was on the Min Min light.
Ah, okay.
Because she had an experience when she was out camping.
Yes.
And so then she decided to take it and make it into like a ballad.
Yes.
Of folklore.
Yeah, it happens.
Yeah, yeah, it was all based on...
And it happens commonly.
Mm.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've seen UFOs. I'm not ashamed to admit that. I've seen these flying discs. A number of us have. They exist. And in fact, speaking of strange occurrences, there was in Australia just recently, or not recently, a few years back, a young family that went to visit the grave of their grandmother. And the mother of the family decided to take a photograph of everybody in the car. When it was developed, there's Grandma sitting in the back seat, replete with glasses. You know, nothing is as it appears. Nothing is as it appears. It happens. Since...
She's thinking, ah, thank God for that. They finally came and got me. Now I can go and live with them.
Yeah. We never, ever visit Glenys' mother's grave.
I can see you haven't got a pastor's hat.
Since November the 23rd, 1968, the US government authorities have spelled out one reason after another as to why a rare satellite photograph captured on that date shows what is very obviously a hole at or near the North Pole. I've got a photograph of it. It's fascinating. The fact that US officials keep updating a variety of reasons for the phenomenon doesn't really do much to satisfy my own curiosity or put my heart at rest, and I'm certain that other people who are also left with a sense of lingering bewilderment are looking at those photographs saying, why don't they be honest with us?
Yeah, that's right.
The photograph, of course, taken, as I mentioned, on November 23, 1968, is a rare photograph. But since then, a number of other photographs have surfaced from satellite images that have been taken of the North Pole and also the South Pole. Now, normally they're covered with cloud. But when the cloud clears, there's a perfect hole. The patriarch Job mentions in Job chapter 26 and verse 7, you might want to look at this, patriarch Job speaks of God hanging the earth upon nothing. Job 26 and verse 7, hanging the earth upon nothing. But he also mentions something else in that same verse. Depending on your translation, it mentions that God stretches out the northern skies over the empty space. Isaiah speaks of the earth as a circle or an orb, Isaiah 40, verse 21 and 22. At a time when other national groups were saying the earth was flat and a heavenly tortoise carried the earth about on its back. Rear Admiral Byrd was in charge of a US naval team that explored the outer rim of a massive opening at the North Pole. When he died in 1957, the US government ordered his personal papers seized and classified as top secret. Byrd flew. Byrd flew, as only a bird could, into an unknown land beyond the pole. He said, in two expeditions, well actually, quoting from Peter Haining, Ancient Mysteries, says, in two expeditions in 1947 and 1956, Byrd crossed or entered, according to which viewpoint one accepts, the Arctic and Antarctic poles. Byrd flew for 1,700 miles beyond the North Pole and 2,300 miles beyond the South Pole into a new, unknown, iceless territory not recognised on any maps. A veil of secrecy was thrown over the Rear Admiral's mission immediately afterwards by government agencies, and only his radio messages and the contemporary newspaper reports remain as clues to what happened. Thank God there are ham operators and that they recorded his messages, and they all are in agreement all over the world. They are all in agreement with what he radioed. But before Byrd left on his 7-hour North Pole flight in February 1947, he said, I'd like to see that land beyond the pole. That area beyond the pole is the centre of the great unknown. You see, we look at our atlases, we look at our National Geographic Channel, we see the Earth just like everyone else sees it. But you know, there are some people who see it a bit differently to the way we see it. And what we've got to do is stretch our imagination. Yes,
exactly.
Stretch our imagination.
Open all the time.
Absolutely.
Wide open.
Wide open. Byrd's radio reports, and these are confirmed by myriads of people listening to his reports, spoke of iceless regions, entire virgin territory, lush grasslands, massive trees, mountains, pristine lakes. Radio reports from fellow travellers, this is not just Byrd, these are the people on the plane, mention a monstrous animal resembling the mammoth of antiquity, seen moving through the superabundant undergrowth. Now, Haining continues, in January 1956, tackling the South Pole, the Rear Admiral sent another puzzling report. He said, and it is recorded, his voice is recorded, on January 13, members of the United States expedition accomplished a flight of 2,700 miles from the base of McMurdo Sound and penetrated a land extent of 2,300 miles beyond the pole. When he returned, he states enigmatically, the present expedition has opened a vast new territory. Ever since, there have been repeated suggestions that the whole discovery was hushed up by the American government to prevent anyone else, the Russians in particular, seeking that territory. Now, this is fascinating stuff, considering what the biblical revelation tells us about the abyss. Hitler himself launched expeditions, Nazi Germany launched expeditions to both the North Pole and the Antarctic in search of an entrance that would take them into the subterranean world within our planet. This is fascinating to my mind, because they believed in an inner earth theory. And you know, the closer we get to the poles, the warmer the currents. Mm. And animals abound. You wouldn't expect to see them. And there is floating timber and vegetation, often cited, all of this along with compass irregularities. So where is the timber coming from? Where is the warm water coming from? Why is it iceless when you go beyond the pole? Why are there animals in abundance? There is ultra secret research continuing at both poles, with international scientific agreement in sharing new insights and data at the top echelons of government. So there are many stories from ancient mythologies that I can draw on for this lecture today. I'm not going to, but I need to return to the Word of God, having said all of that, because this is what we are most interested in, what God has to say about what's under our feet. All right? To start with, I want you to have a look at Revelation chapter 5 and verse 3. And perhaps what I'm about to share with you will help you to have a different perspective on the planet on which we live. No man in the heavens, it says, in earth, or under the earth, was able to break open the seals of the scroll, neither to look thereon. See that little phrase? Under the earth. Now, have a look at verse 13, the same chapter. Verse 13. Every creature in the heavens, on earth, and under the earth was saying, glory and power be unto the Lamb. Jump over to Philippians. Philippians chapter 2 and verse 10. And this is a significant statement by the Apostle Paul, Rav Shaul, because he is quoting from rabbinic understanding of the first century Second Temple period, and he says, at Yeshua's name every knee will bow of things in the heavens, that's angels, things on earth, that's men, and things under the earth. What's under the earth? What's under the earth?
Dead people.
Well, dead people are under the earth. Well, they're actually in the earth. But the phrase under the earth implies something else.
Under the earth.
And 2 Peter 2:4, we read exactly what Paul is referring to, because Peter has something to say in 2 Peter 2 and verse 4. 2 Peter 2 and verse 4. God spared not the angels that sinned, but cast them down under. Now, it doesn't mean they're in Australia. Not down under. But, oh, they are. That's true. But, of course, they're in Tartarus, which means the deep place. To be reserved in chains of darkness under judgment. So, somewhere inside the earth is a place called Tartarus, or Tartarus, and in that place, there are some pretty ugly, malevolent forces. But let's not stop there. Over in Jude, Yehuda, verse 6, angels who did not carefully keep inviolate their original position of preeminent dignity, but abandoned once and for all their own private dwelling place with a view to the judgment of the great day, in age-lasting bonds under darkness, he has placed under careful guard. That's the Greek. I'll repeat that so you can get a very good sense of what he is saying. Angels that did not carefully keep inviolate their original position of preeminent dignity, but abandoned once for all their own private dwelling place with a view to the judgment of the great day, in age-lasting bonds under darkness, he has placed under careful guard. In other words, they are imprisoned. But where are they imprisoned? Beneath our feet. Beneath our feet. And in Ephesians 4 and verse 9, we read about Yeshua. And Paul says that he ascended. But notice what he says in verse 9. But he descended first into the lower parts of the earth. Now, it's not talking about the grave that he was buried in. It's not talking about the cave wherein no man ever laid. It's talking about him going into the lower parts of the earth. And in 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 19, a verse that is supposedly talking about Yeshua and isn't. 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 19. It was in the spirit that Enoch also went and preached to the imprisoned spirits who had disobeyed at the time when God's patience held out during the construction of the ark in the days of Noah. The ark by which only a few souls, 8 in all, were brought safely through the water. Now, in most versions, it has Yeshua or Jesus. And it's just not. And if you look at the original Greek, you will find that it is not. It is Enoch. And indeed, there is no record ever of Yeshua ever going into and talking with, into the middle of the earth and talking with imprisoned spirits. There's no record of that as such. And it even tells us when this was occurring, when this event happened, and it was during the flood. It was during the period of the flood. It says, as when God's patience held out during the construction of the ark in the days of Noah. So it's not even talking about the crucifixion and resurrection period. It's talking about way back in the days of Noah. And that was Enoch. And anybody who wishes to open up the book of Enoch right now, which of course you won't do because you haven't got it, but you should have it, have a look and see what it says between Enoch 17 and 65. I'll write it up here so that you will, if you do get a copy of Enoch, you can look at, I'll just put here Enoch, chapter 17 to 65, and there you will have the whole history of Enoch's experiences when he went into the center of the earth. Yes?
It's very easily downloadable.
Of course, yes. Yeah. I didn't even think of that. Of course.
Just run it up there and just Google it and just download it.
Of course. Great idea. And but that's certainly the way to go. And have a look at those chapters which delineate the voyages of Enoch and where he went at that period of time during the deluge, or just before the deluge occurred in the days of Noah. All right. And, of course, a lot of people have known about what goes on inside the earth. Jules Verne was a great student of the biblical revelation and also a man who greatly respected Jewish people, and his attitude was, you know, I'm going to write this book calling it A Journey to the Center of the Earth. It's going to be full of great, you know, prehistoric monsters living there and so on. It wasn't far off the mark, yes.
He wrote that book from Earth to the Moon. Hmm. And he said three men will make that journey, and he said I don't know whether he said take 94 hours or 96 hours.
11 days.
But he was out by 20 minutes.
He was out by 20 minutes. That's right.
Yeah.
Which is rather interesting. Yeah. He actually he said that voyage would take so long, yeah, and it was just a little bit off. Yeah. But he was a man of science. He was also a Rosicrucian,
yeah,
and they have a lot of understanding of these things. Okay. But you know, there may also be a reference to underground maleficent. Maleficent forces. I've got to get my tongue around that. That's right. Thank you, Robinson. Way back in the command against idolatry. If you go over to Exodus chapter 20 and look at verse 4, Exodus 20 and verse 4, it says, "You shall not make yourself any graven image or any form of what is in the heavens above or what is in the earth beneath," you see, "or what is in the waters under the earth." And demonic spirits in the days of Yeshua were horrified as to the possibility of him sending them into the abyss. They were horrified. In fact, if you look at Luke 8, verse 30, and 31, Yeshua asked him, saying, "What is your name?" And he said, "Legion," because many demons were entered into him, and they besought him that he would not command them to go into the abyss. They didn't want the abyss, anything but the abyss. And it's often translated or mistranslated, bottomless pit. It's not a bottomless pit. It's simply an abyss.
It is if there's two holes on either end of the poles, and that's the abyss. No matter which way you go in, that's bottomless.
I really don't think the centre is like a hole like that. I don't think that's the deal. That, you know, in Revelation 20, verse 1, 2, and 3, you find the Dark Lord is banished to that very same place. And he does not want to go. Right? He does not want to go. But a seal is set upon him so he can't re-enter onto the surface of the earth to influence the nations, which will be on the earth for 1,000 years with Yeshua ruling from Jerusalem over them. So he's restraining him. It'll be an area of terrible restraint for the Dark Lord. But if you notice, he will have to be seized and thrust into the abyss. I find that fascinating. Use your imagination again a little bit. If you have a look at Revelation 20 and verse 1, I saw an angel come down from the heavens, having the key to the abyss and a great chain in his hand, and he laid hold on the dragon, that old serpent, which is the devil and Hasatan, and bound him 1,000 years. Now notice, he laid hold. It says in the Greek, he seized him and held him. Why did he seize and hold him? Well, the Dark Lord is trying to get away from him. All right, he doesn't want to go there. And it says, and cast him into the abyss, and shut him up, and set a seal on him, and so on and so forth. So, you know, even the Dark Lord is not too happy about going to that place. He doesn't want to go there. And so he is banished. He can't re-enter. And he will have to be thrust into it. And when you look back at the great Yom Kippur, event that was practiced way back in the ancient days in Leviticus 16, when the two identical goats were brought before the high priest, and the high priest could only tell them apart by casting a lot. Mm-hmm. All right, one would be for Azazel, and the other would be for the sacrifice goat. One would represent Yeshua, the other would represent Hasatan. But you couldn't tell them apart, you see. Couldn't do it. And that's right, because, you know, we've got an imposter right now sitting on the Messianic throne in Christendom. It's not Yeshua. It's not Yeshua. So here in Leviticus 16, and beginning in verse 20, when he has made an end of reconciling the holy place and the tabernacle of the congregation and the altar, he shall bring the live goat, and Aaron shall lay both his hands upon the head of the live goat and confess over him all the iniquities of the children of Israel and all their transgressions and all their sins, putting them on the head of the goat. Now, please notice, the sins of Israel and indeed of humanity are placed upon the head of the Azazel, upon the Azazel, upon the goat that is going to be banished into the wilderness. Now, Yeshua died for the sins of the world. He was sacrificed, and that other goat was sacrificed. But this one is let go into the wilderness. But he is seized, because it says up here, verse 20, he shall bring the live goat. But the word for shall bring is seize. He's got to seize this goat. And then upon its head are all the accountabilities that he is liable for. But in no way is the Azazel, or the Azazel goat, in no way is he a sin bearer for us. It's not written that that is there. It's basically, he's got to be accountable for bringing or introducing sin into the world. And that is one of the...
You can't take it away.
That's exactly right. But he himself can bear those sins away from the camp. And that is exactly what you just read in Revelation 20. And the Dark Lord is taken, and he is cast into that abyss. He is seized by a strong angel. And in fact, it even says in Leviticus 16, if you have a good look, it's a strong man who actually takes the Azazel and seizes him. It's a strong man. And the person who does so has got to be anyone but an Israelite. No Jew, no Israelite was allowed to grab that goat and seize him. It had to be a strong man, preferably an alien, with emphasis on alien, from one of the nations. Somebody unclean had to do that, which is rather interesting, I think. So out he goes, and after he's been seized, down in verse 22, well, verse 21, and he shall send him away by the hand of a fit man into the wilderness. That fit man has to be fit to handle the powers of the Dark Lord, what he represented. And the goat shall bear upon him. Now see, not bear upon him all of our sins, but shall bear upon him all their iniquities unto a land not inhabited, and he shall let go the goat in the wilderness. And when Aaron's done all of that, guess what he's got to do? Cleanse himself. He's got to wash himself because of the contamination. This was not done in the case of Yeshua. All right. Now, Enoch describes the environment of the abyss as narrow and deep, horrible and dark. So if you're going to download Enoch on the web, it'll be Enoch chapter 88, verse 1 and 2, and you will get his description of the abyss. Enoch went to many places. He didn't just go into the earth. He went out there too and described the various heavens in which he was taken. And in fact, it's rather funny. He mentions at one stage when he looked back and he saw the earth, it was getting smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller until it became just like a loaf of bread hanging nowhere. You know, and this is rather fascinating. It adds authenticity to the account. For Hasatan to be taken against his will and cast into the abyss gives you an indication of the horror that's contained within it. No doubt about that.
So that's very different from the previous description of this land where there's, oh, it's beautiful, that's under the earth as
absolutely.
Well.
So absolutely. So it's like...
So there's more than one place under the earth.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There is no doubt about that. It's like the concept of Sheol. You know, you've got various compartments and departments, and you've got a place where Abraham is in the, you know, and Lazarus is in, resting up against his chest, and they've got peace and tranquility. But over there, all this other stuff's happening.
Yeah.
So you know, you've got these various levels, or shall we say, spheres, where these things are interacting with each other. Just like every few years, Sheol will intersect with Earth. This is rather fascinating, as the Kabbalah makes out very clearly. There is an intersection that can happen, and you will get strange things happening when in... Remember this, everything that's real is in here. Your universe is in your head. And the other evening, I had a call from my son, Amos, and I'm talking to him about family things, and he was asking about some of the things that were going on with our... relatives in days of yore, and when I'd hung up, there was a real feeling of a feeling of unity, which I very rarely have with my cousins and all of that. And then suddenly, our clock, which is never set on the alarm, and if you look at the alarm switch, you've got to push it up for it to be set. Off it went. As soon as I hung up after talking about our relatives. Beep, 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 beep. And we went, whoa, 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 what was that? And we went over, we listened and we saw it was on the back. We pulled the clock out and had a look at the back, and somehow it had gone up into the alarm setting. It's impossible for that thing to go up unless you really, you know, jam it up. None of us ever touch it. It's just there so we can see the time. We've never touched it in years.
Sometimes
how did that happen?
It used to come down here.
Well, that's right.
You know, it doesn't
but never, touched never touched in
and
relation.
And it would go up. Off at
the
same time, twice a day, every day.
Off it went.
Yeah.
But
and it was 7 minutes to seven.
7 minutes to seven when it happened. So things like that can intersect with us. I know that some people have even stayed here and seen our old rocking chair rock. It happens. You know, you will find that it's nothing to be afraid of. I'm like, not at all. There was one night. My sons were here and they distinctly smelt my father. He had a particular scent about him and it went right around through the house. And you go, oh, hello, Dad. You know, this is where Sheol intersects with reality. But remember, it's all in here. It's all in the mind. There is no objective reality. There's only a subjective reality. Yes.
Wasn't there, we were discussing at one time, some time back, about people that were camping on the Nullarbor, and they heard all the noises coming up from the...
Yeah, but that was proven, as I thought at the time, to be a Pentecostal myth that had been circulated. Yeah, and they finally confessed to that. Yeah, but yeah, that's a different story. Yeah. But let me just say this: the strong man who takes the Azazel goat and the one who is in charge of the abyss is not in any way to be confused with the Dark Lord. In any case, because the one who is in charge of the abyss is the Archangel Uriel. He's one of the archangels of the Pleiadian star cluster, and he's in charge of the abyss. He is called this name, Uriel, because it means the fire of God.
Did he muck up?
Sorry?
Did he muck up?
No, he didn't. Not yet, he hasn't. But he is one of the archangels who is in charge of the abyss. Mm-hmm. And he's the one that you read about, the great angel that decides to take the Dark Lord and seal him. And we know that because it's in Enoch as well. That's in 1 Enoch 19. Enoch, chapter 19, and verse 1, and chapter 20, verse 2. But do try, when I mention some of these Jewish scriptures in my lectures, do try and download them. Do try and get access to them. Do educate yourself. You know, that's why I'm here. I'm here to educate people. And you will gain from it. You will certainly gain from the book of Enoch. And it is quoted, incidentally, in the corpus, the New Testament corpus, the Messianic Scriptures. It is quoted there. But Uriel and six other archangels dominate the Pleiadian star cluster, and they are the angels that Yeshua has in his right hand at the very beginning of the apocalypse. They're going to the Pleiadian star cluster is so important that it starts at the, it's mentioned at the very beginning of the apocalypse, and it's mentioned throughout the apocalypse. And I have given studies on that. I won't get sidetracked now explaining all of that, but you do need to, if you haven't gone into the early lectures of the apocalypse, get into them, have a good look at them, especially in relation to the seven archangels. You'll find it very, very interesting, particularly in relation to the planet Venus as it circumvents the star cluster itself at the end of the age. When those two rise, catastrophe is coming. And interestingly enough, it is going to be in the next can't think of the word. Anyway, in the next decade, that they do come together in a conjunction. That's Venus and the Pleiades. Right at a time when, of course, the great symbol of the Ark of the Covenant will be seen in the heavens, that conjunction of Moloch and... I'm having a great time today. Come on, George. The Eastern... Sorry?
Kiyun.
Thank you. Kiyun and Moloch. Thank you very much. That conjunction, because they're the two angels over the Ark of the Covenant. All right. So, but you know... if you turn to the prayer of Manassas, right? Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. When you all get the Apocrypha and you can go to the prayer of Manassas, chapter 3, you will find, or verse 3, you will find this statement. It says, "You who close and seal the abyss with your fearful and glorious name is a Lord." So, you know, the Lord is superintendent. When we read the Apocalypse, when we read Enoch, when we read the Prayer of Manassas, when we read Zechariah, when we read Haggai or Zephaniah or Isaiah or any of the prophets, you've got to understand this is not all accidental. God superintends all things, all events, all personalities. He's in charge of the affairs of angels, archangels, demonic powers, human beings, governments, councils. God's in charge. If you get Satan out of the picture a little bit and stop letting him dominate in your thoughts, and you look at God as being the one who is in charge, and Satan is simply his lackey to do what God wants in the negative sphere, then you will have things in proper perspective. Remember, it is not Satan the devil who's hiding under the couch or behind the shower curtain. All right? Forget psycho. Forget all of that. It's God who's hiding there. He loves a game. All right? Stop being afraid of the dark. That's what I'm trying to say. So we know that when this horrendous event occurs and the abyss is opened and these creatures start coming out upon the land that we just read about in that section of Revelation, we need to know that the only ones that are going to be harmed by those creatures are those who do not have the seal of God in their foreheads. What is the forehead called? Temple? Isn't that the temple? That's the temple of the skull. And therefore, behind the temple, you will find the Holy of Holies. All right? That's what you'll find behind the veil of the temple. The temple is there. You've got the upper and the lower temple. All right, we might get into the technicalities of that. But yes, that's true. But that is the temple. All right, that's the temple. And you will find that those who do not possess that seal of God will be the ones who will be afflicted. What is then the seal of God? Yeah, absolutely it is. And because the spirit of truth is the spirit of right knowledge, it is God's knowledge of who you are. God's knowledge of who you are. And the fact that we belong to him. If you turn to 2 Timothy chapter 2, you'll find this spelled out. So don't expect at the end of the age to wake up one morning and you go into the bathroom and you go, what's that? And written across your forehead is something in indelible ink. It's not going to happen. I've read that that's going to happen. There are people out there who said one day you're going to wake up and you're going to find, you know, God has written on your forehead. And, you know, you hear all this nonsense.
Yeah, okay.
Shocking. 2 Timothy 2 and verse 19. The foundation of God stands certain, having this seal. The Lord knows them that are his. Yeah. You see, the Lord knows them that are his. And let everyone that names the name of Mashiach depart from iniquity. Obviously. Obviously. So if you're God, if you belong to God, get rid of all the other trappings. I'm going to use another word. You get rid of all of that. Get rid of it all. Because you belong to God. You're separate. You're separated. You're unique. You're an individual. Remember the life of Brian? You're all individuals.
I'm not,
says one little voice. I love that scene. But you know, these creatures that are released upon human beings are essentially like locusts in appearance. Now, I'm going to tell you a horrible story. I've got time. Horrible story about my wife and I. We'd had a conflict at one stage. Well, you know, married couples do. And we went to bed in a bit of a huff. And Glennis, of course, was in the right. But
you're a cruel.
It was something silly, like I didn't put the toilet seat down or something. Or whatever it was. Silly thing. And we went to bed in a bit of an argument. Anyway, in the middle of the night, we both woke up with a start. And we looked around and we saw the atmosphere of the bedroom had remarkably become very, well, you could almost reach up and touch it. Yeah. It was like a thick atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And we were both awake. It wasn't a hallucination. And suddenly it began to form and it began to crack like there was a distortion in the atmosphere. And suddenly something started to put its claws out through the atmosphere. And we're both lying there in the semi-dark of the bedroom looking at this something that was coming through. Anyway, Glenna started to scream. And I was not exactly in charge of myself either. And it was coming through, and at the other one, the other claw came through, and it started to rip it open, and this horrible looking thing started to come through. And Glennis was, you know,
huge.
It was massive. And I just grabbed hold of her, forgetting that I hadn't put, you know, done what she wanted me to do. Whatever it was, that all went. It didn't matter anymore. That's right, it didn't matter anymore. And we just held each other, and she said, what are we going to do? And we were praying, but it was still coming through, and I said, it will not touch us because it can't penetrate where love exists. Okay? And we were enveloped with not only love for each other, but the love of God,
amen,
which transcends it all. And as soon as I said that, that thing began to withdraw. It was like a complete reversal. Like a film running backwards. And back it went, and Glennis was watching it too. It wasn't in my mind or her mind, it was our mind, we saw it. So here, at the end of the age, these creatures are going to come through into the atmosphere from an invisible vortex. And they are going to look like locusts. That thing that we saw was more like a cockroach. It was more like that kind of thing. But
Big body
thing. But they do bear many of the characteristics of locusts. An Arabian proverb speaks of the locust as having a head like a horse, a breast like that of a lion, feet like a camel, body like a serpent, and antenna like the hair of a maiden. And I find that interesting. I find that interesting because that's precisely what you're reading in the apocalypse, that this thing is, these things are like. And the prophet Joel, if you want to turn over to Joel chapter 1, he gives a description of the stark terror involved in a future destructive onslaught of real locusts in the state of Israel in just a few years from now. After Israel prospers and is doing very well and saves the West, all of that's going to take time, incidentally, but they will not repent before God, and God is going to send a locust plague of gigantic proportions. It's even called the Day of the Lord, the way Joel writes it. If you have a look at Joel chapter 1 and verse 4, that which the palmer worm has left has the locust eaten, and that which the locust has left has the canker worm eaten, and that which the canker worm has left has the caterpillar eaten. Awake, you drunkards, verse 5, and weep, and howl, all you drinkers of wine, because of the new wine, for it is cut off from your mouth. For a nation has invaded our land, strong and without number. His teeth are the teeth of a lion. He has the fangs of a lioness. Have a look in verse 15. Alas for that day, for the day of Yahweh is at hand, and as destruction from the Almighty shall it come. And again, if you look at Joel chapter 2 and verse 1, Joel 2 and verse 1, blow the trumpet in Zion, sound an alarm in my holy mountain, let all the inhabitants of the land tremble, for the day of Yahweh comes, for it is at hand. Drop down to verse 4, the appearance of them is as the appearance of horses, see, like the Arabian proverb. And they run like war horses, as chariots rattle, they leap upon the hilltops, like flames of fire that crackle, consuming the straw, like a vast army in battle array. Look at verse, drop down to about verse 10. The earth quakes before them, the heavens tremble, the sun and the moon are darkened, the stars withdraw their shining, and Yahweh utters his voice before his army, for his camp is very great, for strong is he that executes his word. For the day of the Lord is great and very terrible. Who can bear it? Now, I know there are a number of Bible expositors and commentators who see that vision of the locusts in the apocalypse, and they see choppers. They see these helicopters with gun cannon at the end of, at the back of the helicopter. And when you look at it, you know, up it comes and shooting fire out of these cannons. You could say, yeah, you know, that's pretty right, because John really couldn't describe a helicopter, so he would have called them locusts and all of that. But you know, if that is correct, then John is describing a world war, and if that is correct, these groups are actually linking these locusts or these helicopters, these choppers, with the Assyrians, because the Assyrians are mentioned in the Bible as being like God's locusts. So if you link all these things together, you come up with World War III and you come up with these helicopters. Only one problem. Even though helicopters do look like grasshoppers, do look like locusts, and I have no reservation as to admitting that, locusts eat green vegetation. And these locust creatures, or scorpion centaurs, as some are describing them, are not permitted to hurt any green thing. But helicopters that are firing these rockets destroy vegetation. They destroy trees. They destroy forests. Look at Vietnam. The napalm destroyed whole miles and miles and miles of Vietnam and all the people in between, who may or may not have been Viet Cong, you know. Yet these are not permitted to hurt any green thing. So they cannot be helicopters. They can't be helicopters. All right. Nor are they allowed to kill anybody. Well, hello, if they are choppers and they're shooting their cannons out, guess what? What's going to happen to them? They're not allowed to kill anybody. Well, choppers can't do that. They kill people. They destroy vegetation. All they are allowed to do is inflict endless, horrifying, torturous torture.
Conditions.
Yeah. But that affliction that these people receive as a result of getting bitten is like a scorpion's bite. I've never met anyone who's had a scorpion bite. But I've seen it on the idiot box. I've seen it on this thing. And the excruciating agony they go through, and they want to die. They beg to die. They're saying, please just put me out of my misery. And that's what it's going to be like in the future with physical and mental suffering. But for some reason, it says death will elude them. I've entitled the lecture, Death Takes a Vacation. And that's exactly what will happen to these people. They will be unable to die. But like locusts that attack vegetation, locusts attack in the five dry summer months. And how long do these things have control of human beings? 5 months. 5 months, just like locusts. And we are told in Proverbs, and I want to show you this, because this is most important, in Proverbs. This is one of the very few things that you can look at and say, well, this would absolutely contradict the idea of these actually being locusts in Revelation. If you have a look at Proverbs 30 and verse 27, it says, and it's very clear, the locusts have no king, yet they all go forth in groups. Okay, now this is interesting, they have no king. But the locusts over in Revelation have a king. The name is Abaddon and Apollyon. Mm-hmm. So they have a king. So again, these are not normal locusts. And you can't say that Abaddon and Apollyon is Hasatan, because Hasatan does not have a name. He doesn't have a name. He's never been given a name. He'll never have a name. All right? But here, this king over the locusts is called Abaddon and Apollyon. So Hasatan merely wears a title. He doesn't have a name.
Is that the only place that Abaddon is mentioned in the word?
Abaddon?
Yeah.
I think it is.
Mentioned somewhere else in the scriptures.
Well, whatever. Both mean destruction. Both mean destruction. But the irony is that the god is not allowed to kill men, even though the king is called destruction. Is not allowed to destroy men. Yet they will agonize for death. And yet it's incongruous to my mind. I just want to share this thought. They will linger for death to overtake them because they want to escape their torture. But the next thing for them, if they did die, would be the lake of fire. Hello? I mean, you know, escape from a lingering torture of 5 months for a long period in a lake of fire, to my mind, just doesn't seem right. It seems, you know, this is just how pushed these people will be mentally, wanting release. They won't even be able to think clearly anymore. pretty horrifying. Now,
could there be people from outer space?
They very well could be. Again, as I said at the very beginning of this, when that meteor comes to the Earth and John sees it fall, the Greek word means it's fallen, and it's already happened. It's past tense. So this might have come from outer space. We have no idea. And as I said before, in many lectures previous, there have been a number of invasions of this planet. And I've shown that from the biblical record, and I've divided it up into period A and period B and period C. And I've talked about when the first invasion occurred, how they intermingled as the Bene Elohim, the sons of God. They went ahead and intermingled with human beings. You know, earth women were easy, that's how they saw it. And so they began to propagate and have their own children. And God finally said, there's only one family that hasn't been polluted by these extraterrestrials. He said, and I'm going to get rid of the whole world and just start with this one family. And God destroyed the whole world at that time. But then it says in the Genesis account, it happened way back then, but it happened also after that. So even though God had corrected the problem, it happened again. You see, and it certainly is a bit of an enigma, that whole story. But be that as it may, I have mentioned that with the apocalypse, there are just like Zechariah, there are two ages running parallel. You've got the first century. And you've got the last century, which is ours. And they run parallel. And things were happening in the first century that the apocalypse records. Namely, Nero was called the beast. And Nero persecuted the Christians and blasphemed for a period of 42 months, or 3.5 years, or 1260 days. That was a fact. That's recorded. And indeed, the people who lived at the time said that you can count the number of Nero's name, the letters in Hebrew and or in Greek, and you'll come up with 666. So there is a first century fulfillment of the apocalypse. It's called the preterist interpretation of history, of theology. And I'll go along with that. I'm not going to argue with that. In fact, many of my lectures on the apocalypse have been about the first century and how certain things were formally fulfilled. But there is also, running parallel, the last century. And you'll find that the Antichrist will come, and guess what? He's going to do the same thing. He's going to rule for 42 months. He's going to blaspheme and persecute believers, and he's going to have the cryptic number of 666. So it all runs parallel. And by the time I complete this series of lectures on the apocalypse, and I'm trying not to smile when I say that, there will be a tying in of the first century and the last century together. I'm going to show you just how they both parallel in events as well as personalities. I'm looking forward to getting there. I'm sure you all are too. But Apollyon, and this is why I'm mentioning the two ages. If you go back into the first century, into the Second Temple period, you will find that Apollyon is just another name, a form of Apollo. Apollo. And the symbol of Apollo was the locust. I find this interesting. Who thought of himself as Apollo in John's day? Nero. In fact, on his coins, he has the features of Apollo. And, of course, when Rome burned, he took the guise of Apollo and took his lyre and strung it. He didn't have a fiddle, the fiddles weren't invented, but he did have a lyre, or some call it a lyra, and he played that as Rome burned. And he certainly was given to a devotion to that deity, Apollo. Certainly the whole cult of Nero in Asia Minor centered around Apollo, and that was a Neronian cult. And the people of Asia Minor all worship Nero as a god, and indeed the god Apollo. So here you find that John uses the cryptic term Apollyon. He's having a shot. He's having a shot at Nero. And certainly his Jewish wife, Poppaea, who was the lover of Simon Magus, who was the court magician for Nero, had conspired to destroy those who worshipped a crucified Jew and who had exalted him as the emperor of the world. So that, you know, Nero didn't really like Yeshua all that much, for sure. But Intriguingly, Kittle, in his The Revelation of John, written in 1940, says in both the Hebrew and the Greek name, that's Abaddon and Apollyon, John's readers would see the symbol of the impending destruction that awaited the ungodly at the time for destroying the destroyers of the earth. So just as there was an application of Antichrist in Nero in the first century, who blasphemed God, as I've mentioned, and persecuted the Christians for 42 months or 3.5 years or 1260 days, and whose name adds up to 666, so Nero, as a follower of Apollo, was designated cryptically in this scroll as destruction, or as perdition personified. You might prefer that phrase, perdition personified, because he was mad as a mad hatter, and he most certainly, you know, anybody that would kill his mother after having sex with her, and, you know, Nero had problems.
It would seem that way, wouldn't it?
It would seem that way. It's another one of John's wonderful derogatory slights against Nero as a manifestation of the powers of the underworld. You know, and I take my hat off to John for having the guts to do that. Any wonder he wrote the apocalypse in symbols, and, you know, so that it wouldn't be easily cracked by the agents of Nero who were examining his works while he was on Patmos. But whatever the case, we have to also understand that there is a further first century application to John's vision, because the Roman troops of Gessius Florus cast terror over Judea for exactly 5 months. And when did they do it? In the summer. In the summer period, when, of course, the locusts would be out there eating the crops for 5 months. So, again, it parallels beautifully. And one should add this to your repertoire of facts about the Second Temple period. The helmets of the Roman legionnaires who were involved in the destruction of Jerusalem were burnished with gold, precisely as John described the helmets of the locusts as gold. So in 6 short verses, John describes the first 4 shofar blasts. 6 verses, the shofar blasts, 6 verses. Yet he's devoted an entire chapter to the first 2 woes. That should show you how important this is. Professor Seiss, and I'll finish on this, Professor Seiss sums up the first woe. Friends and brethren, the judgments of God are coming. They are coming. The agents for them are ready and at hand. They are to alight with awful severity upon the rebellious and ungodly. They will not be delayed either till this life is over. They are coming in this present world. And you see, this is what some of us, we tend to think, because I have revealed to you and have shown you through painstaking study and all of that, that it's not going to happen tomorrow, and it's not going to happen in 2012, and it's not going to happen in 2015, but it's going to happen. It is coming. It is coming. It says they are coming in this present world. Men shall feel them while they yet stand upon their feet and go on with their unbelief and earthiness. The other night, we happened to be parked in Tweed City, and there were some drunks sitting in the car park area there, and they saw what was written on the back of our car: restoring Yeshua to the biblical revelation since 1981. So they started. Yeah, Jesus, and go to church, mate, more often. Gobble, gobble, gobble. Then I didn't hear it, but as Glynis came out from where she was, they said some pretty horrendous stuff. And had I heard it, I'm glad I didn't, because if I had, I would have been out of that car. Again, I'm not pastoral. I would have been out of that. I would not be thinking of the lost in a positive way. I would have wiped them off the face of the earth because of what they said to her. But she got in the car and she said, "Did you hear that?" I said, "No, I didn't." "What?" So she told me, and then of course it was a matter of, you know, start the car and get out of here, because it would have. Well, I'm not known for my brotherly love sometimes.
They wanted me to perform a task.
Yes, but let's not go into that. But, you know, as it says here, men shall feel them while they yet stand upon their feet and go on with their unbelief and earthiness. Hell is to be let in upon the living earth, and no human hand can stay its torments. As the generations of the rebellious and the unsanctified complete their 5 months of horror and writhing under the scorpion stings of these infernal tormentors, the first woe will be fulfilled, whilst yet 2 other and more horrible ones follow. God Almighty, in his mercy, Save us, he says, from the evils of those days. It says in Revelation 9:12, the first disaster is now past, but I see two more approaching. All right. And we will discuss this in 2 weeks' time. Are there any questions on that?
Have you read Tom Holland's book on Apollyon?
Have I read?
Tom Holland. He's written a book on Apollyon.
No, I haven't.
Yeah, apparently he covers a lot of these things in his book.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.